The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Good afternoon on this Monday afternoon. If you want to contact our programme today, it's 51551 for your text, or you can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. Of course, we're here till 4:30. 4:30 today. Congratulations and well done to everybody who took part in the Operation Transformation 5K in the Phoenix Park on Saturday morning. It was bitterly cold. It was one of those wind chill mornings. So if you looked at the thermometer, it might have been saying 6 or 7 degrees, but it felt -4 because there was a wind sweeping down Chesterfield Avenue that it take you apart. But it didn't dampen the enthusiasm of the 5,000 people who'd signed up for the 5K, and there's always a beautiful, lovely, life-affirming atmosphere at that. I've been there for the last 5 or 6 years, and just the people who go to it want to be there. They're going through a transition in their lives. A lot of them are doing the 5K for the first time. There's a nervousness about it, and then when they get past the finish line, there's this enthusiasm and joy, and look at me, I've done so well, and just it's a lovely morning. It's a lovely morning. And I met the Stonyford crowd. We broadcast live from Stonyford in County Kilkenny a few weeks ago. Pamela had been up for the selection process and she didn't make it onto the telly. So she went back down to Stonyford and she said, listen, we're going to do our own mini Operation Transformation thingamajig. And she did. And she got Tara and William and Neil and Lisa and Fred, who'll always be Carl to me, as leaders. And they did great work down there. With walks and runs, and the local cafe had the Operation Transformation menu on, and they just did great, brilliant work, and they were all there on Saturday morning. And I ran around the 5K with Pamela, and she did brilliantly. She knocked 10 minutes off her PB, which was brilliant. And of course, the leaders were there as well, the ones you've seen on telly over the last 8 weeks. Is it Shane and Tanya and Lorraine and Andrea and Barry? They were full of the joys of spring as well, because for them it was a big day. They were doing it. Most of them were doing a 5K for the first time. They walked it and ran it, and there were tears of emotion and joy at the end of it. And then last night they were up here in RTE Donnybrook Dublin 4 for the finale of Operation Transformation. Of course, you'll see that on Wednesday night on the television at 9:35. That's where they get their new goonies, and they get, you know, the whole makeover thing, and they parade up the catwalk. You'll see all that on Wednesday. And actually, they're coming into us on Wednesday afternoon before that. So we're looking forward to talking to them all and getting all the gossip and how they got on Operation Transformation. And we have a little vox pop type thingy as well later on in the programme. Niamh was out there with her recording machine, and she spoke to people at the 5K on Saturday. So we'll play that, wind and all. Just before 4 o'clock. Speaking of catwalks, Birkenstocks are back in fashion. It's official. How do we know it's official? Well, they were spotted on the catwalk for Valentino. And Valentino knows his onions when it comes to fashion. And if Valentino says there's Birkenstocks, well, there shall be Birkenstocks. They never went out of fashion with me. And I was a bit slaggy about Birkenstocks back in the day. I thought only hippies wore them. And, you know. Anyway, I was convinced by my better half to buy a pair of Birkenstocks about 15 years ago or thereabouts, probably 12. And I bought a pair, and they lasted me for more than 10 years, and only bought a new pair last year. And I'd swear by them now. I'd swear by Birkenstocks. And in a world of fast fashion, if you can get 10 years out of a pair of thingamajigs, that's good going, isn't it? And I had to confess upstairs, and I'll confess to you now as well, I've taken to wearing my Birkenstocks around the house of an evening with socks. I know. What would Valentino think about that? It's probably the height of fashion. Complete accident on my part, but people think about these things. Anyway, they sold, believe it or not, 30 million pairs of Birkenstocks globally last year. And they come in all colours. They sparkle. They're bright and colourful. They have men's. I think I'm just traditional. They look like ones that you would have bought in the 1970s. But you can buy silver ones and white ones and brown ones and black ones and blue ones, and they're all there. How are you on your Birkenstocks and wearing them around the house in socks? Do let us know. Joe was talking about that, the coronavirus and the effect of travel, and they were talking about it on the news at one, and now there's a big outbreak in Italy, and people who've planned holidays in other parts of the world, how are they going to be affected? Well, we've sent one such query to Conor Pope, who's going to be with us later on, and he'll be answering what rights you have when it comes to cancelling a holiday due to something like the coronavirus. So we'll be speaking to him about that. And I heard a taxi driver on wondering what was going to happen with the match on March 7th. Ireland are playing Italy in the Aviva Stadium. And will that be cancelled or what's going to happen there? But the shine has gone off Irish rugby after yesterday's game. Oh, so disappointing. And I was full of hope. I don't know why. I'd read a few articles and there were other people full of hope. So I was full of hope. I got the chicken wings in and the crisps and lit the fire and ready for a 3 o'clock sitting in front of the telly. Come on, Ireland, go on! And within 6 or 7 minutes, you knew it was over. You just knew it was over. You know, one of those days where there's no coming back. A couple of mistakes, confidence shot, and very difficult to come back from that. Anyway, we still have won two games. We're hoping to beat Italy, and then it's France, the final game, who are, until today, they're still unbeaten, our France. So we'll watch that. What else did we spot today? There's no surprise. Eating more vegetables and fruit will prevent stroke. They've done research on 418,000 people in 9 European countries. It's one of the largest studies of its kind. And they found that higher intakes of fruit, vegetables, fibre, milk, cheese or yoghurt, which is a bit of a surprise, were each linked to a lower risk of ischemic stroke. And that's the stroke that affects an artery going to the brain. So I think a lot of this is common sense, isn't it? A lot of this is common sense. Fruit, vegetable, healthy stuff, and you will be healthier in the main. That's the way it works. Lonely Planet have come up with an alternative Irish bucket list for travel lovers. So they're gone off the beaten track, and these are things that you may not be aware of that you should try and seek out in Ireland. I'm looking at most, I haven't been to most of these places. Four Knox, Stamullen, County Meath. It's a prehistoric site. The Dursey Island cable car, I've been out there, I've seen it, I haven't been on it. But it's out there on the beautiful Ring of Beara. They used to put Catlin and everything on it. Maybe they still do. Meet Irish winemakers, Wicklow Way Wines Winery. There's a tongue twister in that. It's okay to say it now, but after two bottles of wine, try to say Wicklow Way Wines Winery. Where have you been to? I've just been for a visit to Wicklow Way Wines Winery, just for the afternoon. It's lovely. And then seek out an extraordinary beach. There's so many extraordinary beaches in this country that to name two isn't fair on the rest of them. But they do name two, and they name Coral Strand, looking out on Manon Bay near Ballykeneely in Connemara. And they name the Coral Beach near Dleask Pier in Sneem, County Kerry. And then Slieve League, which gets mentioned every time we mention the Cliffs of Moher on this programme. We get a text to go, Slieve League, they're taller. More famous in Europe. We don't appreciate them in this country. They're up there in Donegal. If you go to Donegal town and take a left and keep going till you can't go any further, you'll hit Slieve League. And the viewing platform's out there, and it is quite spectacular out there. And they say kayaking around Loophead Peninsula. The best kayaking I've ever done in this country. And I think we were very lucky that particular night. We went out with Jim Kennedy off Rean Pier, which is a few miles outside Union Hall in West Cork. And it was a beautiful, still summer's night. Not a cloud in the sky, not a breath of air. It was still, just like, which is unusual when you're on the west coast of Ireland on the Atlantic. And myself and Jim and Liz, who used to work on the programme, went out in our kayaks. And then we witnessed bioluminescence. You know this thing where there's bacteria and all sorts of small little creatures. And when you disrupt them at night, they give off light. And it's like the most amazing light show. First of all, he did it in the sea, and then he brought us into a cave and he used his paddle to upset some of the microorganisms on the wall of the cave, and it all lit up like a big disco. It's just amazing. I think we were lucky, just the night that was in it. And Jim is such brilliant company. He knows everything there is to know. Anyway, if you have any other things around the country that people should be visiting, off the beaten track now, ones that aren't promoted by Bord Fáilte, it's not Bord Fáilte anymore, is it? It's Discover Ireland. Let us know about those. Now, on Birkenstocks, what are Birkenstocks? Some kind of shoe. Yeah, they're sort of a sandal thing in its most basic form. Don't do Birkenstocks, Ray. I called them Jesus sandals. I was of the same opinion back in the day, but I came around to them. They're so comfortable. And then they're like a second, you know, they're like a second skin because they mold around the sole of your foot. They become part of you. Emily in Galway says, I love Birkenstocks, so go you. Rock them in your socks. They're so comfortable and you can make them popular here again. We don't need Valentino. I don't know if I'm going to take that on, Emily, but thanks. I'm living in the States. A lot of teenagers here wear Birkenstocks with crazy socks. It's the fashion. They even sell them online as a combo. Very comfy and last forever. So I'm ahead of the curve when it comes to socks or Birkenstocks. Only in the privacy of my own home. I won't be doing it anywhere public anytime soon. 51551 ray at rte.ie. And coincidentally, they were talking about transgender people on Liveline today. And we have a very interesting and informative conversation with Max and Victoria. Max is a transgender man. Victoria is a transgender woman. They're in their early 20s and they're in a relationship. And we have a chat with them. It's pre-recorded this morning, so we can't ask them about what was mentioned on Liveline. But it's coming up in about 10 minutes' time. Meanwhile, 51551, ray at rte.ie. Good afternoon. Yeah, we've a lot to get through today, so we'll just play maybe that in its entirety some other day. That's John Cougar and Jack and Diane on RT Radio 1. Marae in Dunboyne says, in the 90s, I worked on an intensive care unit in a hospital in Munich. We all wore Birkenstocks for work. Very comfy, more comfy than they look. You can get them in plastic now as well, Marae. And the South Wall in Dublin, well worth a visit, says Michael O'Sullivan, out to the Red Lighthouse. Lovely walk out there on a nice day. 51551 on ray at rte.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551 ray at rte.ie. Now I'm joined in the studio by Max O'Flynn and Victoria van der Speck. Yeah. Good afternoon. Now you two are a couple and you're featured in a documentary on Wednesday night on TG Cahir. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Both of you are transgender. Would you describe yourselves as a transgender couple, Victoria?
Not very regularly, I suppose.
It's not a term to choose.
No. We're a couple and we are...
The cute, annoying couple.
Yeah, generally that's how we'd be described. But no, we're
just... I should tell people at home that you're holding hands, which is very, very cute. Very cute. Now, throughout this interview, I may say things that, you know, aren't correct. Because there's a whole language around transgender and we're all getting to grips with it, people outside the transgender community. So if I do, I apologise in advance. It's not in any way malicious or yeah. I don't mean to make you feel uncomfortable, but I'd love to be corrected.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And I think the more open conversations we have, the better it gets, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So how did you meet, Max?
So we went to Closh Disploder together. We were on the same course in like 2013, which was my first course in the Gaeltacht.
Fido.
And then in 2015, we went with the clubs on a trip up to Tato Park. So there was the one bus going from Carrick and Shannon to Longford to Cavan. So we just ended up on the same bus, me being on the Carrick and Shannon one. And then so we just kind of started talking and I think... I didn't know the Irish word for dyslexia, so Victoria taught me, oh, it's dyslexia, and we just kind of started chatting that way.
Do you have dyslexia?
Yeah,
we both.
Both have dyslexia? Yeah. Right.
And then I added her on Facebook because she's the very memorable name of van der Speck, and we just kind of started talking.
Okay. And what's your memory of it? Was it love at first sight, Victoria?
Not exactly, no. It's definitely a relationship we've worked on.
We were definitely
friends. Definitely hit it off. Yeah,
we were friends for the first while. And I kind of started developing feelings for this person that I was talking to. And then, after about 2 months, she came out to me as being trans. And then, a few months later, we kind of...
It had been in my mind for a while at that stage. So at that point, it was some kind of random person from Leitrim that I was just kind of like, if I can't come out to this person, like, I'm just going to be in the closet forever. So I just kind of went for it. Yeah.
Were you presenting as male?
At the time. Yeah.
Okay.
And nobody knew. Max was the first person I told, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you feel that's a big responsibility, Max?
I guess, but I didn't feel like that big of a deal to me because I think I was very kind of open about being LGBT from about like 13, 14. And when Victoria met me, I had like short, multicolored hair and piercings and tattoos. So I'd say I definitely thought
I can't come out to this person.
What were you? You were presenting as a girl.
Yeah. So I was just kind of that alternative, I suppose, teenage girl kind of thing with short dyed hair and piercings and stuff. So
you sort of found a kindred spirit, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where were you at then at that stage?
So when we met, I was just kind of angsty 17-year-old, just kind of... Yeah. We were both in our Leaving Cert at the time, and I think I was kind of going through my own struggles with depression, and at the time I had a girlfriend, but we kind of broke up a little while later, just the dynamic wasn't working out too well being long distance. And
so you entered into another long distance relationship.
Yeah, pretty much. But the person that I was going out with at the time has also come out as a transgender man. So we're still friends and kind of we update each other. I think he started taking testosterone 3 weeks before I did. So we kind of like we'll message each other on occasion just for like updates on like, oh, how are you getting on?
And when Victoria came out to you as a transgender woman, what did you know of transgender at the time?
I didn't really know an awful lot. Like I knew an awful lot about being like bisexual and gay and all that kind of stuff. And when Victoria told me that she was a trans woman, I was like, I don't really know what that means, but I'm going to try and educate myself on that. So I kind of started doing my own research to help this person.
And how did you explain it to Max, Victoria, on that that day, evening, night, morning, whenever it was?
I just kind of messaged him over Facebook. It was very kind of, I could take my time with it and kind of think about what I was saying, but I was also kind of in a bit of a panic. I'd been looking into it and researching it a bit by myself whenever I kind of had a chance of my own on the internet, but I kind of was looking for a bit of support. And this person was, as far as I knew, kind of quite pro-LGBT at the time, so... Yeah,
she was very dramatic in the way she did it. She kind of so we had been messaging like every single day since we kind of met, I suppose. And then I think one of the days she kind of said that I've been lying to you. And then it was just kind of like she didn't really kind of message me back. And I was a bit kind of annoyed because I was like, oh, well, I've been opening up to this person. And now this person has been lying to me. And so I remember being a little bit annoyed and angry. And there was kind of like a whole day where I was kind of in a huff. So I didn't message you. And then you were kind of messaging me like, hey, you usually have sent me like 20 messages by now. What's going on? And I was just like, what do you mean by you've lied to me? And then she kind of said, well, I feel like a girl. And I was just like, oh, okay.
At the time, it felt like more of a thing.
Well,
it is
a big thing.
It is a big thing, but it did feel like this is someone that I should have been open with, I suppose, from the start, because like that I had no reason to not be.
I was also the first person you were coming out to as a trans woman. You were in an all-boys school. There was a lot
There's a lot going on.
I've grown a lot since then.
And Max, so you were in a lesbian relationship.
I was.
Yeah, and how did you, do you have to give yourself a label?
No, and in like, so there's two parts of me that's kind of like, labels, they're not necessary, like, you just are what you are. And then there's kind of the science in me that's just kind of like, if you don't have something labeled, how can you work with this chemical in the lab? It's not labeled, dangerous.
The way you've described it there is nearly the core of the crux of this for a lot of people, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, labels aren't like, they shouldn't be a huge, big thing, but they're important to some people because I remember when I started experimenting with gender fluidity and kind of telling that to Victoria, she kind of struggled with the idea of a in-betweeny gender because she knew that she was a binary trans woman. She was just like, oh, well, then are you not just kind of like a trans man kind of thing? And I was just like, well, I don't know. I don't know if I want to put a label on it just yet. And I think it's kind of important to some people to say, I am this. And because I think a lot of people grow up without having that language. And then once you kind of find a word to describe how you're feeling, that label can be very important. And I think we do kind of need to understand that not the biggest thing, but also to respect some people who feel the need to have a label. Okay.
So when did you come out as a trans man then, Max?
It was kind of a slow process, I guess, because I was kind of experimenting with gender fluidity when we went to our first Pride, and I was kind of wearing masculine clothes and was like, yeah, no, I feel like a man today. And then, but it was a slow process of kind of realizing, well, actually, I'm uncomfortable with being seen as a girl, and I don't think gender fluidity is the right label for me. Because I think I was feeling a lot more masculine as time went on, and I realised that I wanted to start taking testosterone and to have top surgery and to be seen by the world as a man.
So would you be old enough for that to happen to?
It depends. Like some people know they were trans from like a very young age, and then some people, they don't figure it out until their late teens like we did. Yeah. Some people don't figure out until they're like in their 50s. Like there's no definite age that someone should know their gender by.
So you mentioned then hormone treatment and top surgery.
Yeah.
Okay. So hormone treatment for you was taking testosterone.
Yeah.
How do you get a prescription for that? Because I'm sure you can't just go into your local chemist and say, give us a bottle of testosterone there.
So in some countries, there is the informed consent model where you can go to your GP, say that you are trans, and you kind of sign off on this consent form saying that you understand
ramifications, what, I suppose, of HRT and that kind of stuff.
Taking this hormone. But in Ireland, we have the psychiatric model. So you need to go to a psychologist and a doctor, and you need to be diagnosed with gender dysphoria. So there's that kind of lengthy process of kind of like, well, are you sure you're trans now? Like, do you know what this means? And that kind of thing.
A lot of uncomfortable questions that kind of seem a little bit outdated sometimes.
Yeah, almost a little bit kind of interrogational. So you get this diagnosis from a doctor and from a psychologist, and then they will refer you to one of the only three endocrinologists in Ireland that deals with transgender patients.
Right. And then they will prescribe testosterone.
So I was lucky enough to go privately when I had a job and income to afford the going up to Belfast and getting privately, but I can't afford that anymore, and I'm still waiting to be seen in Loughlinstown.
Victoria, you said that a lot of the questions you were asked seem sort of a bit outdated now.
Well, not a lot of them. I suppose some of them, like there are certainly a lot of trans people who aren't sure of themselves, and seeing a counsellor is probably important for a lot of trans people, regardless of the gender issue. There are some of them that, especially there are a lot of very invasive questions about how it's affected your sexuality and that kind of stuff, which can be seem a bit strange. I don't know, especially when you're kind of a young adult, it can seem a bit daunting.
And do you think the psychiatric model is outdated?
There is kind of a morality issue in that if a trans woman is a woman, the same as a cis woman, why do they need to go through the clinical process in order to get the same thing that a cis woman could just walk in and get very easily from the GP?
Yeah.
The same hormones.
Because it is in the DSM, isn't it?
It is.
Gender transphoria.
Gender
dysphoria, sorry. Which is a diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders. And that must, to all of everything that's going on with your body and with your head, to know that you've been diagnosed with a psychiatric abnormality.
You do not need to have gender dysphoria to be trans, though. Experiencing gender euphoria, simply if you're okay with being a man, let's say, but being a woman is much more preferable, that you would still be classified as trans. Whereas under this model, you would have to almost lie to them and say that you experience dysphoria in order to actually live a happier, healthier life.
Because with this model, non-binary people, so if there's a non-binary person who is assigned female at birth and they see taking testosterone as a fundamental part of their transition, they would kind of have to lie then to a psychologist and to a doctor saying, oh, I feel like a man, you know, please let me start testosterone, even though they mightn't fit in the neat binary box of being a man. Their gender may be a little bit more ambiguous than being 100% male, but it's the same for a non-binary person who's assigned male at birth and maybe wants to start taking estrogen.
So in the documentary, They follow you and your family, and you go as well, Victoria, to Poland to get top surgery. So you've a double mastectomy.
Yeah.
Talk me through the thinking in the lead up to that, and the way you had to wear, is it a binder?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the binder is a compression vest, and a lot of trans and non-binary people would wear that to flatten their chest, just to have maybe a more masculine appearance, or just to kind of help them cope with the discomfort of having maybe a larger chest. And I kind of knew from doing my research to try and help Victoria that, oh, some people have top surgery. That's something that I like that idea of. So it was kind of in the back of my mind for a good few years. And then I saw one of my friends who posted on Facebook that he had top surgery in Warsaw. And I just thought his results looked amazing, and just kind of the scars were so minimal and things. And he was only after just having the surgery. And so I kind of started doing research, and actually a lot of trans masculine people in Ireland would go abroad to Dr. Lembas in Poland. It works out a little bit cheaper than going to the UK, and his results are very well. And at the moment, the one and only surgeon in Ireland who has done top surgery for trans masculine people has retired, and she's not taking on any new patients. So it's kind of the only option we have is to go abroad.
And do you need a letter of referral?
So the process for having top surgery with Lembas, he requires that you are at least 18 years of age, and that you have either had your gender legally changed, or you have started taking testosterone. And at the time that I had started looking into it, I was on my way to like changing my name by deed poll, changing my gender legally. So by the time I actually got going to have top surgery, I had started testosterone by going privately up to Belfast. So I was about 5 or 6 months taking testosterone before I had top surgery.
Right. The changing of the name, So you can decide, which is a luxury that most people don't have, because they're named at birth, and as you said, all you can do is poo and eat or whatever. So is that a big thing? Did you put a lot of thought into your name, Victoria?
Personally, yes. I had a whole list of them, and I shortened it down to about three: Victoria, Elizabeth, and Samantha.
Right.
Each of them had a bit of a story behind them, but. I chose Victoria. I liked Roman history, and Victoria was the goddess of victory. So every time it was called it was a little victory. So. Yeah.
and it goes, it's alliteration as well, because...
Yeah, Victoria.
Victoria Van Der Spek, yeah, yeah, which rolls off the tongue, which is good. Yeah.
Solid name.
Yeah. Yeah. But a lot of people would kind of... a lot of people have a lot of thought into it. A lot of people just pick a name they kind of like. A lot of people pick a name of someone they admire. A lot of people as well, though, you'll find will have, even binary people, will have kind of non-binary names, like Max or Sam or Alex, kind of gender-neutral names.
Francis.
Yeah.
Tony. I'm just coming up.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a lot of people who do explore other ways that they could present themselves, different genders, before they decide on a binary gender. Even if they do, like... Of course, there are people who are non-binary for their whole lives, but I'm just saying people who even are binary can end up with non-binary names because they've just had that name for a while, even while they were exploring.
I see.
There's a lot of pressure then for people that if they pick a name, they can't mention it to anyone for ages until they're certain themselves, or they can't explore because, oh, what if people think that I'm faking it?
Mm.
So I think... Like, personally, I just kind of wanted to go with a unisex name that was short and kind of ambiguous.
You say in the documentary, which is on TG Carr on Wednesday night as part of the Taboo series, focus on the things that cause you dysphoria. So you're referring to your voice and how you go to speech therapy,
yep.
Victoria. And obviously you're trying to bring it up a few octaves, is it?
Well, there's multiple aspects to speech. To feminize your voice, what is more stereotypically perceived as feminine. Pitch is one of them, absolutely, but it's less important than you think. There are plenty of cis women with kind of huskier voices, especially if they smoke or drink or something like that. There's tonality. A lot of cis women especially will kind of speak a lot softer, and they won't have such harsh kind of K's and T's and stuff like that. And it's a whole process of learning, I suppose, how to speak. Probably in a generation or two after mine, no one will have to do this.
Yes.
And hopefully it'll just be acceptable to speak.
And
do you
feel that we're in this period of huge change, and if you just look at the stats, even on the number of people presenting as transgender over the last 10 years, they've, you know, quadrupled or, you know. So do you think that when we get to the other side, it's going to be a lot easier?
Hopefully.
Yes.
It's easier for left-handed people now. They're not hitting school and stuff like that. So
gay people.
Things do get better, and people kind of get more acceptable.
And what about being misgendered then?
How does that
affect you if you're referred to as a man, Victoria?
It can be soul crushing at times. Sometimes
you've long red hair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the moment, anyway.
All right. And I'm just trying to. Can you articulate to me? That you know, when you look in the mirror in the morning before you go out, what goes through your head? And then if you go into some place and then somebody doesn't see you as a woman, how does that make you feel?
There is kind of a disconnect, I suppose, because you know yourself that someone doesn't really have the power to take your internal gender away from you and take who you are away from you, but they do still have a certain ability to just kind of make you feel bad. 99% of the time it's accidental. But it's just, especially if you tried really hard, and specifically for me with my voice, I can wear all the makeup in the world and have a dress and everything. But as soon as I open my mouth, someone generally slips up within the next 10 minutes.
But you've been on estrogen.
I've been on estrogen. Estrogen doesn't affect your voice. Testosterone will.
Okay.
Right. But you can only generally kind of lower your voice. Now, estrogen does do one or two things. It might soften it a little bit or stuff like that. But generally, it doesn't have the same kind of...
And you've had no surgery?
No.
So what about you in the future? Because you've sort of met quite young. It's been very intense because you came out to Max. Max came out to you. And you were there when Max got his top surgery and started his testosterone treatment and everything like that. It's very intense, hasn't it been? More intense than your average relationship.
I suppose.
Let me tell you as an outsider. So what about the future? Have you talked about the future?
Definitely. Yeah.
And what sort of chats do you have?
I suppose children, marriage, that kind of
having a house full
future.
Of dogs.
Yeah, you know, some a bit more serious than other, but
I think that was one of the things that I kind of was attracted to by our just kind of openness to be able to kind of talk about things that we kind of want to do in the future and just kind of different things. Because I remember talking to you and how you would want to maybe parent. And I always thought that was interesting, and just how you kind of thought how you would do certain things, and just our ability to kind of talk about some of these things very openly, where some people they're in a relationship for how long and they
realize after 2 or 3 years that one of them doesn't want kids or something like that.
Yeah, or you're so far down the line, or you're married or something, and then you realize that this person hates dogs, or they don't ever want to go on a family holiday to Spain or whatever. So
the children thing then. You, Victoria, have stored sperm.
Yeah.
Okay. And what would happen, do you think?
Like, we've talked about children, and I'm not sure myself if I would carry a child. I don't know how fertile I was before I started taking testosterone. That's kind of one of the difficult things as well, because I could have been infertile before. So I think from a young age, knowing that I was LGBT, I've kind of accepted the idea of maybe adopting kids, because I didn't know if I was going to be a woman in a relationship with another woman or whatever. And like, there's plenty of heterosexual cisgender couples who may experience fertility difficulties. And well, I suppose like we're both only like 21, 22 still have a lot of time left ahead of us.
But you have to plan for it. So would you?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. At least you have to plan in order to have the options.
So you have your frozen sperm.
Yeah.
What about frozen eggs?
I didn't. Before,
much more expensive as well.
But
a lot of the aspects of HRT that people kind of say are irreversible, a lot of them aren't.
Right.
A lot of them, like, they're absolutely, there's multiple people who, once they start HRT, will never be able to biologically make children again. But again, like I said, you do need to be careful, and everyone's an individual.
Case, yes.
The statistics do not care about the individual.
How are you two now? Because both of you have suffered with depression.
Mm-hmm.
How are you now?
Much, personally, much better than I was before starting HRT. I still have a long way to go. You know, struggling with who you are in an all-boys school, feeling like a freak for your entire, half your childhood, like you're... It's probably left some damage.
Yeah. When did you first get, you know, that sensation?
About 10 or 11. The only examples I had of anyone who was vaguely trans at the time was Jeremy Kyle show, someone to be brought in as kind of a freak show, or Ace Ventura or something like that. Not exactly great role models out there. As much as there's been complaints, and I have things to say about her as well, but Caitlyn Jenner has been perceived more positively, and that was a big step in 2015.
What have you got to say about her?
She's one person with her own political views and that kind of stuff.
With her own story, like in the way that we're kind of representing ourselves, and like we don't represent the entire trans community. Caitlyn Jenner doesn't represent us either. She represents, I suppose, her side of kind of being not finding out until much later in life, and then I suppose affording to be able to transition how she did. Like, not everyone is in the financial situation to be able to.
And most people aren't.
The vast majority of people.
And I know, going on the documentary and coming in here, you're speaking for yourselves, but in a way, you are a sort of a voice for the transgender community.
As much as you try not to be for a lot of things, like, you are.
Yes.
You have to acknowledge that.
So how do you feel about the debate, the ongoing debate about transgender? And a lot of the people involved are not transgender themselves.
What do you mean by debate?
You want me to say it, don't you? But there's an ongoing debate, for example, about, you know, women are fearful that transgender women will come into their spaces. That's one part of it. That's just one part of it.
There's
loads going on.
You see this throughout history, and a lot of reactionary voices always have the same few arguments. It's always...
It's always the vocal minority.
It's always a very vocal minority, but even if you go back to, like, civil rights era America, it's a lot of the very same things, just you replace trans person with black person, and it's, I'm fine with black people, I just don't want them in the same bathroom as my daughter.
Right.
And you end up with a lot of very, very similar slogans. It's a reactionary fear.
Yeah, and they call it the bathroom wars in America. So how does that work out for you two on a day-to-day basis?
Thankfully, Ireland is much better than America. It's fairly easy to... Like, it's still a process, and it is emotionally taxing, and there's a lot of... There's things to be improved, but comparatively to the rest of the world, legally changing your name and your gender is relatively easy and very thorough, really.
Mm-hmm.
You get a birth cert and a passport with your right
name. Which you've done, correct? Victoria.
I'm still going through the process. I had a bit of a bureaucratic mix-up, but that's not the general story.
And what about you, Max? Are you officially...
Yeah, so I'm legally Max, and I've legally changed my gender to be male. Yeah. And I think neither of us, like in terms of bathrooms, we've never really had a negative experience other than maybe like a few looks. But
I've gone into McDonald's and I've come out of the bathroom and there's been the manager there staring at me. But once or twice, you do get some things like that. But legally, they can't do anything. So we do have that advantage in this country.
It's one of those weird things. Whereas if you boil the whole debate down, I suppose, you're just kind of, you're worried about other people's genitalia and what bathroom they're using. Like, everyone just wants to be able to use the bathroom to do whatever we need to do and just get on with our day. And
it's a very irrational fear.
Well,
because statistically, if you look at it,
I know
a trans woman walking into the bathroom is much more likely to be the one to have something happen to them than...
Yes.
Especially if a trans woman who is fully transitioned or even partially transitioned walks into a man's bathroom, it's a very high likelihood that they'll get hit.
What we haven't mentioned at all, and we're just coming to the end now, are your families.
Yeah.
Coming out to your families, what was that like for you, Victoria?
There was one or two times I was going to come out. My parents, I should have come out because they do love me and they move earth and heaven to help me. But when you're young, a lot of things are very scary. I was going to come out during the gay marriage referendum because there was kind of an air of LGBT support and stuff. But my mom is kind of religious and she did end up voting no in that, which scared me back into the closet for a few years. But honestly, as soon as I came out through a letter. I just wrote it. I left it on the kitchen table and kind of waited for my mom to come home. I was absolutely terrified. I put off for a while, but Max kind of convinced me that you kind of need to start.
You know, just before the leaving cert.
Yeah, you know, the perfect time. They've honestly, my mom especially, but my entire family have been
phenomenal. And who else is in the family?
Just my mom, my dad, and my brother.
Okay.
Cats and dogs.
Well, cats and dogs, of course. Yeah, my other siblings. But no, my mom's done phenomenal research. She's really, really put her best foot forward and tried to help me as much as possible. My dad's is from the Netherlands, so I think he's just been a bit more chill about it in general. But it, not saying it was easy for him, but it wasn't something he expected to happen.
Because they're sort of, I suppose, and people say this, but it's a cliche because it's probably true, that they're grieving the life they thought you would have.
You have a plan for your child. Yes, yeah. And that is changed a bit, which I suppose in one way shows how differently we treat men and women.
They mourn the expectations they put on this little baby when it came into the world, yeah. I suppose, without really realising it. But
yeah.
Yeah.
And Max, your dad features in the documentary. He goes with you to Poland.
Yep.
And you're the eldest of three.
Three, yeah.
Yes. And the other two, you've two brothers.
Yeah, I have two younger brothers. Hi, Daniel and Saul. So I suppose it was maybe a little bit more difficult for my family going from having a daughter and two sons to having three boys. My dad was great. He kind of... He was a bit on the fence because I feel like he didn't really, I don't think he felt like he could process it in the way that he could. But he felt very strongly that a parent should be with me while I go for this surgery, because I suppose it's not the most invasive surgery, but still it was the first surgery that I was ever going to have. And at the end of the day, I'm still his child. So he came over with me and he was a great support, because I think when I was kind of planning it all, I was kind of ready to kind of go it alone almost. So it was a nice surprise to kind of have that support.
Right.
And just for a lot of parents out there, I suppose, like, I'm still learning about a lot of things. Like, I only know my experience of binary trans people. Like, I'm sure there's plenty I don't know about non-binary trans people. So, like, you will learn a lot. I'm still learning. Everyone will still be learning about this, but
every person's story is different.
Everyone's person's story
and how you do it and what surgery you want to do, all different.
Yeah. Because not everyone wants to have surgery. Not everyone wants to start hormonal therapy. Some people,
trans women who are okay with a beard and that kind of stuff. Like, it doesn't make you any less of a woman.
Like, there's plenty of people out there who, like, I suppose maybe drag queens or I suppose gay men, and they're happy being called, referred to as, like, she, her and Yas Queen and all that. And they're like these big kind of maybe scruffy men with beards, but they have like these immaculate nails and eyelashes and they look fabulous.
There is an increase in gender nonconformity, which is very beneficial for a lot of trans people who are trying to explore themselves.
Yeah. It's kind of like a great kind of fuck you to the standards.
Which leaves, this is the final thing. So will there be a world where we won't have to put the, you know, transgender before woman?
Hopefully.
I don't know if I'll see it, but hopefully. There's a lot of, like, Twitter of all places, you can see a lot of people having their kind of their bios and handles and stuff like that. They'll say, even if they're cis, they'll put their pronouns in. So they'll be like Kiro, She, She, Her.
Yeah. Right. So pronouns, like I would use he, him, Victoria uses she, her. Yes. And it's kind of a great kind of ally thing that was started within just kind of the LGBT community in general, just kind of these cis people that were putting their pronouns in. And like, I know within IT Sligo, we have some great kind of allies that would kind of put their pronouns at the end of their email and just kind of to bring about more awareness.
Yeah. So the more that's something that cis people can definitely do to kind of bring about a more accepting world for trans people, is to just make pronouns, saying your pronouns like saying your name if you're being kind of introduced and stuff like that. Even if you think it's obvious.
What should I say?
Well, just Ray Darcy, he, him.
Right.
Even if you're just in an email.
If those are your
like
pronouns,
that,
yeah. Unless you prefer to be like he, yeah. They, them, she, her.
Not you judging. Have he, they on your
yeah. Yeah, so I don't mind if someone uses he, him or they, them when referring to me. And I think it's just a way of trying to prevent people misgendering and just kind of to open up the conversation of just...
You see, in a way, sometimes I think that shuts down the conversation because people are so scared of saying the wrong thing.
Well, that's why we kind of... Some people have pronoun badges so they kind of know, okay those are the yeah. correct...
Do you see the argument? Victoria,
the argument is, though, that they're afraid of it because they don't come up against it. If they see, if it was in their daily life, it would just be normal.
Fine.
Yeah.
As well, just little things like if you're writing an email, let's say, just like, sir, madam, other... Like just normalizing that kind of
just
stuff is very
normalizing gender neutral right. language yeah. instead of like okay. he or she, you can just say they.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being so honest today. And if people want to see Max and Victoria, it's TG Cahir Taboo on Wednesday night. Max, thank you.
Thank you.
Victoria.
Thank you.
Good thank luck to you both. Us. Quick commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Forgot to remind you last week about the fact that we're going out and about. We had planned to do it during January, but we were sort of postponed because of the election. But we have the roadie and the roadcaster and all sorts of things. So we intend to do OBs over the coming months. And we have a file in the office and we're going through it and we're making plans to visit certain places. But if you have a group in your locality or there's something particular happening and you think... that it justifies an outside broadcast on RTE Radio 1. Well, then do send us an email to ray@rte.ie and we may be visiting your locality. So, for example, we were down in Stonyford to meet Pamela and all the Operation Transformation people there a couple of weeks ago, and that's the type of thing. So there were six people who were doing something together in the community and their sort of, I suppose, what they were doing had repercussions for the rest of the community and everybody was involved and it was lovely and it was outside the local community centre. It's that sort of thing we're looking for. Anywhere in the country, we will travel. Have Roadie, we'll travel. ray@rte.ie. And we got time for this. We don't really have time for it. So I'll just go to a couple of texts there. Just on Birkenstocks. I was an au pair in Germany in 1997. The first thing the family did was bring me to the shop to buy Birkenstocks as they didn't wear shoes inside the house, only Birkenstocks. I still wear them now. Best 40 quid ever spent. I don't think you can get a pair for 40 quid now. And Ray says, Nolan O'Byrne, if Lonely Planet, etc. keep telling us about hidden gems to visit, the whole country will be ruined. I wish people would keep special places secret if they're lucky enough to happen upon them. Many of them can't take large crowds. Howth Cliff Path is a case in point. It used to be magic. It's ruined now as council are making it tourist friendly, i.e. destroying it, says Nolan O'Byrne. Maybe they're just introducing health and safety, Nolan O'Byrne, but I see what you're saying. Jim Kennedy, the man with the kayak, off Rean Pier down in West Cork. I'm in Mexico at the moment with some Irish groups. Thank you for the mention. Your fame even reaches here. Go on, Jim, you chancer. Now, we've another commercial break to take before we get to Noakt.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551 ray@rte.ie. We are meeting the Nobel Peace Prize medal very shortly. But before that, Conor Pope.
Is this a surprise for me? Did I not did I not get the memo? It's for me, Ray, isn't it?
What have you done to contribute to world peace?
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah. But you have over the years.
I've done more than Henry Kissinger.
Right. Well, that's a debate we won't have here and now. Now, these are hot off the presses.
Yeah, it's the big story of the day.
People are worried about travelling and the coronavirus. And this is just a sample of some of the texts we've got in throughout the afternoon. I wonder if you could offer advice to people who may, as a result of the coronavirus, have flights cancelled or accommodation booked in areas impacted. For example, half of Ireland seems to be in Bella Italia in Verona, northern Italy, the last few summers I was there and booked there for this summer. Thanks in advance.
Yeah, now this is a story that an awful lot of people have been contacting us about in the last few hours, and there's been a dramatic spike in the number of cases of the coronavirus across northern Italy over the last 72 hours. I think six people have died of the illness. It's a very fluid situation, and so the question an awful lot of people have now is it safe to go to northern Italy? And it's kind of on the back of it was much easier for people to say, oh, oh, I wouldn't be going to China, because a very small number of people in Ireland go to China. A very small number of people from Ireland go to China as tourists. I contacted the big tour operators who look after China several weeks ago, and there was nobody from Ireland on their tours, and there was only dozens booked in for tours in the weeks ahead. But when it comes to Italy, it's a completely different story, because it's a much bigger deal. Now, what is the best advice? Well, the best advice I can give for starters is people should avoid panicking, okay? Because it's a really fast-moving situation, and it's difficult to say with any certainty where we'll be by the end of this week, never mind where we'll be by the middle of the summertime when this person is looking to go camping in northern Italy. So we shouldn't be losing the run of ourselves and saying, oh, that's it, I'm not going camping on my summer holidays. That's it. Because apart from anything else, there's a likelihood, and this is according to the Department of Health, there's a likelihood that there will be cases of the illness in this country. You know, it's going to happen probably. So, you know, why would you not go to Italy to avoid the virus if the virus is in this country as well? So the best advice is to avoid panicking. And the first place that people should turn when it comes to travel arrangements to any part of the world, but in this example, we're talking specifically about Italy, is the Department of Foreign Affairs. Now, they have issued an advisory this morning warning against travel, but not warning against travel to Italy. So there's no blanket ban against travel to Italy like there was when they issued an advisory about China. But what they've advised people to do is to avoid travelling to impacted areas. And they've outlined some of the restrictions that are in place. There's going to be a restriction of movement in and out of certain areas. There's going to be a restriction of certain transport, a suspension of mass meetings, football matches, all that kind of stuff. And Irish citizens are advised not to travel to affected areas. But of course, what are those affected areas? And it's important to stress again that it's not everywhere in Italy. So for instance, Milan Airport is open, Rome Airport is open, Venice is open. So those areas aren't impacted right now. And there's a list of 10 towns, and I won't go through the list of 10 towns because
people can look them up. Yeah,
they're on the Department of Foreign Affairs website. And you can go on to the DFA website and you can find out what are the impacted towns. Now, that could change by the time this programme ends. That could change by this evening. But as it stands, that's the situation. Now, the question then is, well, what would I do if? Now, if an official advisory is issued by the Department of Foreign Affairs that advises against travel unless it's absolutely necessary, then people who have holidays booked there can, generally speaking, claim under their travel insurance because they've been told by the state that they can't go. So through no fault of their own, they're unable to travel, so they can make a claim under the travel insurance. And generally speaking, tour operators, if you've got a holiday booked with a tour operator, they will reschedule the event or they will refund the money or whatever it might be. Now, so that's what happens if there's a general blanket ban, for want of a better word, on travel to a particular area. Now, there isn't that in Italy. And then, of course, the question is, what do you do if you are there, or what do you do if you're going there next week? And I think what we have to do in this scenario is we maybe just need to dial down the panic a little bit. Now, I'm not a medic, as you well know, and it is an incredibly serious scenario that we're facing into. But I think sometimes people can get really scared when they see the top lines and when they hear the headlines. So, you know, all of the advice from people in the United States and who are experts on disease control and all of that stuff, you know, there's simple things that you can do. So you might want to reduce the amount of time you're on public transport. You might want to carry around the alcohol based sanitizers. And if you touch a surface,
is this if you're in Italy or even here?
If you're anywhere where there's you know, this kind of illness is doing the rounds. And it's the same advice, and this is actually what one of the leading medics in America said, is it's actually the same advice that we're being given all the time. You know, like, good hand sanitation is really important, you know. Don't, you know, avoid large spaces where there's large amounts of people congregating. And just, like, do the common sense things to protect yourself. But you have to remember that, you know, as I say, we can't just cut ourselves off from the entire world. And, like, you know,
I think your advice at the start is the advice, don't panic.
And let's see how it plays out, because over the next week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 6 weeks, things are going to change. And, you know, and we don't know where we're going to be. So, but as I say, if you have your holiday booked for July, August, July and August is a long way away.
Sit in your hands for the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure, and wait to hear what the official advice from the government is. And when the state says you can't travel to X region, well, then you have to be looking into it.
Right. And we'll keep a watch on that, obviously. Now, we've a few minutes to do this one. I bought a Huawei P30 Lite worth €220 from Three online from their website on December 2nd. 4 days later, I rang Three as the touchscreen not working to find out how to send the phone back. On December 9th, it was sent back by me by registered post with Unpost, which was within the 14-day full refund period. I rang thinking I would be getting a replacement phone, and that was the first I heard about a 14-day refund. I was told that the money was in my account, which it was not. Then I was told it takes 28 days for the team to analyse the fault in the phone. They questioned if I had sent it back at all, as the warehouse couldn't find it, even though on the Unpost tracker online it said my package had arrived. I've made 10 phone calls, chatted online with them twice, have gotten 12 validation codes, but still no money.
Yeah, this can all be condensed into the last sentence there. I mean, all the phone calls, contacting them on web chat, trying to make contact and just looking for the money back, because they spent all this cash on a phone before Christmas.
€220.
The phone wasn't working. Now, a lot of the time, you know, we talk about your rights as a consumer. You have the rights to a repair, replacement or a refund, and the retailer gets to decide which of those that you get. Now, that's not the case in an instance like this where the product breaks almost immediately after you buy it, because if the product breaks within a very short time frame after you buy it, the assumption is that the fault was there when you bought it, so you're entitled to a refund. Now, actually, this listener thought she was getting a replacement and she would have been happy enough to get a replacement, but it turns out they were going to be processing the refund, and that would have been well and good, but she's a student, so she got the phone before Christmas, wasn't working, and she had to then go and spend another couple of €100 on another phone, and then she was out of pocket. Now, for some people, €220 or whatever it might be isn't a huge amount of money. For somebody who's a student and maybe, you know, doesn't have a lot of cash, it is a lot of money. So the delay was unacceptable, and the endless over and backs were unacceptable. And the fact that she would speak to a customer service agent in the company on one occasion and they'd say, yeah, we're going to resolve it, we're going to escalate it, and nothing would happen. And then she'd contact them via web chat and they'd say, oh yeah, we're going to get it fixed, and nothing would happen. And all she actually wanted was the €220 to be put back in her account. It's not rocket science. This is not a hugely complicated problem that the company, T-Mobile, had to fix. So I contacted them middle of last week, and they've got in touch with me. They sent in a statement to say that the problems arose as a result of an internal systems error that meant the money wasn't getting from their accounts to her account, and they have now fixed that internal error. The refund has been processed and the matter has been resolved. Okay. But again, we talk about these things all the time. It shouldn't have to come to this point.
Yeah.
These problems should be fixed. And to be honest, internal systems errors happen. Like, mistakes happen. We're all human. And glitches happen in computers and people make mistakes. But it shouldn't require that many phone calls. Yeah.
For somebody. I've made 10 phone calls, chatted online with them twice, have gotten 12 validation codes, sent one email to Conor Pope on RT Radio 1.
And the problem is now resolved.
Yes. Conor Pope, thank you very much. PriceWatch@RTE.ie if you want Conor's help with any consumer issues. And we'll speak to Conor again next Monday. Thanks, Conor.
Thanks a lot.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Val in Limerick says on text 51551, really impressed by Max and Victoria. Regardless of gender, your guests are so mature for their age and have great clarity of thought. As regards gender, my view is live and let live. Hope they have happy lives. That's Val in Limerick. Now, the Nobel Peace Prize is one of the 5 Nobel Prizes established by the will of Swedish industrialist, inventor and armaments manufacturer Alfred Nobel. And right here now in studio, we have a Nobel Peace Prize medal, and it's been minded by Justin Robinson, who's an historian with Samlerhuset. How do you pronounce it?
Samlerhuset.
Samlerhuset Group, and they're the people who make the medals. And this is the same medal, the same design as would have been made the very first time.
Yes, it hasn't changed. It's been the same design from 1901 when the medal was introduced. And it's been designed actually by a Norwegian sculptor called Gustav Vigler.
Right.
And so the design, the front and the back, hasn't changed at all in that time.
Now, Alfred Nobel, an amazing person.
Mm.
Right. And the story of how he set up, I suppose, the foundation.
Yes,
that is over the Nobel Prizes is very interesting. Will you tell us that?
Of course I can. Yes, sure. Well, Alfred Nobel's greatest invention was dynamite. He also invented gelignite as well, and became had a huge number, I think 350, over 350 patented designs with his inventions.
A lot of them were weapons and stuff.
Primarily like that. So, yes, yeah, that's right. Yes, all kinds of devices, but also used in the building industry as well, but very sort of destructive sort of armaments. And he actually became a hugely wealthy man, had factories all over the world. But in 1988, he got to do something which most people don't get to see. 1888, he got to do. He actually got to read his own obituary. His brother died tragically, and a French newspaper actually published Alfred Nobel's obituary. So he actually got to pick up the newspaper and read what people were going to say about him.
Mistake.
Yeah. And the actual headline read, "The Merchant of Death is Dead." And it went on to say, Dr. Alfred Nobel, who became rich by finding ways to kill more people faster than ever before, died yesterday. And apparently he was so upset and horrified because he realised that this is what his legacy was going to be, that this is why he instructed in his will to create these prizes for medicine, for physics, for chemistry, for literature, his great passions for science, but also a special medal for peace as well. And that's what that came about as a consequence of him accidentally reading his obituary and discovering what people were going to think of his legacy.
Isn't that a mad thing? I imagine there are people all over the country, Justin, going, I wonder what my obituary would say.
Well, that's right. That's right. And a few of us get to read it. I know Mark Twain...
I prefer if I didn't get to read it. Thank you very much.
Well, Mark Twain once reported, he read his own obituary and he wrote a letter to the newspaper and said, reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated. So I think that's right. But in this instance, it worked very well. I mean, Nobel wasn't married. He didn't have any children. So he decided he would leave his entire considerable fortune to setting up these prizes.
And that was 31 million back in the day.
It was. It was a huge amount of money. Yes. Amount of money.
And what were his instructions in his will?
Yeah, well, he decided that, as I said, he wanted a fund that would be set aside for the awarding of the annual prizes. And in his will, he said it would go to those who, during the preceding year, shall have conferred the greatest benefit on mankind. So he was thinking very much about peace. He was thinking very much about, obviously, all of the sciences as well, medicine, chemistry, as I said, and...
Here's the other and loads of interesting things. Before we get to talk about the Irish connections, obviously over the years, but Sweden and Norway.
Yes.
So some of them are given out in Sweden, some of them in Norway. Explain that to me.
Sure. Okay. Well, this was again in his will. This was exactly how he'd set it out. So that the literature prize and the prizes for physics, chemistry, and medicine, they are actually awarded by the government of Sweden, so they are given out in Sweden. It's the peace prize that is actually struck in Norway, and it's actually bestowed. And the Norwegian government every year they elect a panel of five people. They're completely independent and non-political. And they sift through all of the nominations that have been received for the recipients for the Peace Prize that year, and they make the final selection. So it's Norway have always done that. Norway have always had that.
So when he was alive, Sweden and Norway were in a union of sorts.
They were indeed. That's right. But he wanted it specifically. He wanted the Peace Prize to be dealt with by Norway, and that's really where our connection comes from. Because, as you said at the start, the Samla Huset Group actually owns the Mint of Norway, and we also own the Dublin Mint Office. And so it was as a result that we were exhibiting at the Dublin Mint Office. We're exhibiting at the RDE at the weekend at the International Coin Fair.
Yeah.
And so it's obviously the sister company, and so Norway, the Mint of Norway, agreed to loan the medal to them for the duration of the weekend. So it was great.
Now, where will this medal end up, or is this a display model, as they'd say?
No, this is
DOD Electrical.
Well, when a recipient receives the Nobel Peace Prize, we engrave their name and the year on the side of the medal, on the rim.
Okay.
So that then obviously becomes their medal. Now, this one is the only one outside of Norway that doesn't have an inscription, because it hasn't yet been awarded.
What's it made from? I've put on gloves now. I can pick it out of its box, so
yes,
to speak.
Yes, well, it's obviously made from gold. And since 2015, Samla Huset have actually been striking the medal in Fairmined gold. And Fairmine gold is gold that's been sourced from small-scale mining operations under the Fairmine standard. And the Fairmine, it's a bit like Fairtrade coffee. They work to improve the quality of life for miners and their families by investing in their sort of health and safety in communities. So it's a very noble thing to do. And as I said, the Fairmine label has been around for a few years now, and Sam Lahusett has been championing that in the industry because we want more and more people who buy gold and silver coins and medals to actually be investing in the Fairmine label.
It's a beautiful piece because it looks old.
Yes, well, that's right. Well, the design, as I said, from 1901, from Gustav Vigeland, who was the Norwegian sculptor.
And is there a different design for each of the areas?
Yes, they do. Yes. So the other medals will all have slightly differing designs.
Okay, but will one side has his, I presume that's him, Alfred
Nobel. Yes,
Bell.
That's right.
That's him on one side. And then on the inscription on the other will change depending on whether it's peace medicine.
That's right. So for the Peace Prize, that the medal actually has a very nice sort of inscription on it. I'm not going to even attempt the Latin inscription,
Latin,
but it translates as "for peace and fraternity among people." And so it's a design, it's symbolic of peace and people coming together in peace.
So there are a number of these in Ireland, on the island of Ireland.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, well, over the years, it's the Peace Prize has been awarded to five Irish people, four from Northern Ireland, one from the Republic of Ireland. So in 1974, Sean McBride, the president of the International Peace Bureau, won. And then 2 years later, the prize was awarded to Betty Williams and Mairead Maguire, founders of the Northern Ireland Peace Movement, later, I think, renamed the Community of Peace People. And then a little bit later again, in 1998, John Hume and David Trimble both won the prize together for their efforts to find a peaceful solution to the conflict in Northern Ireland and for the Good Friday Agreement. So Ireland has a very good and track record of winning the Peace Prize.
And they're in stellar company.
Yes.
So 1901 was the first, was it?
So the first award went
in 2020, and they weren't given out during the World Wars.
Yeah, they're not awarded every year.
Oh, are they not?
So,
right.
So there was a period during the First World War and in the Second World War where they weren't awarded. They also weren't. There've also been a few key dates where the medal hasn't been awarded. So, for example, in 1948, it was widely believed that Mahatma Gandhi would win the Nobel Peace Prize, but unfortunately, he was assassinated.
Right.
And because the medal can't be awarded posthumously, they chose not to actually give it out that year.
Right.
So in honour of Martin of Mahatma Gandhi.
And what way does it work, Justin, or do you know much about this? Is there a shortlist every year?
Yeah, so what happens is a list of nominations is received every year. They can come from governments, from the United Nations, and also previous recipients as well can also submit recommendations. And then a panel of five people in Norway will sit down and they will spend the whole year sifting through all of the nominations to decide who will actually receive it. And it's awarded in December. It's actually awarded on the anniversary of Alfred Nobel's death. So they have a whole year then to make their decision of who's going to be.
Yeah, and the people who've received it are standout names from history.
As
you would expect.
I mean, some of the great sort of inspirational, influential people of the 20th and 21st century. And you have people like Dr. Martin Luther King, for example, in 1964. Archbishop Desmond Tutu in South Africa in 84. Mother Teresa won it in 1979. The Dalai Lama. Nelson Mandela in 1993, and also Barack Obama in 2009 as well. And in 2014, Malala Yousafzai became the youngest recipient of the Peace Prize. She was only 17 when she actually received
it. Well deserved.
So we've had some fantastic company, absolutely.
Any controversy around it over the years?
Yes. I mean, the Nobel Prize obviously has had critics. I mean, there were some people who were very critical when Barack Obama received it, because I think he'd only been in president for about 20 days, I think, or so before the award. But no, I mean, the Nobel Peace Prize has had its critics over the years, And I think it's people will recognise. I think they can see the motive behind the prize, which is always to remind us that it's better to strive for peace and understanding than to wage war. And the Norwegian Nobel Committee, their determination to recognise and honour the achievements of individuals and groups who've worked to make this world a better place, I think, and embrace our shared humanity, I think that can only be a good thing. So, I mean, there have been some controversial decisions. In 1935, for example, the award actually went to an anti-Nazi journalist who was actually in prison in Germany at the time. He was a political prisoner. His name was Karl von Ossietzky, and Adolf Hitler apparently was absolutely furious furious that he had been awarded the Peace Prize and forbade any German citizens to actually receive any Nobel Prizes at all for the next decade. Okay. So they'd certainly had its fair share of critics over the years.
This is a bit vulgar, but has it ever gone up on the open market for sale?
Once.
Right.
That's right, yes. Okay. So there was the recipient in 1935, Carlos Lamas from Argentina, who was the president of the League of Nations and a mediator in a conflict between Paraguay and Bolivia. And his family put the medal up for auction in New York about 4 or 5 years ago, and it fetched $1 million.
Woo!
So it's, yes, absolutely.
What I'm holding in my hand is worth considerably inscription
at the moment. There's no inscription on it. I mean, you're holding almost a quarter of a kilogram of solid gold in your hands now.
At market value, what's that?
Certainly with Fairmine gold, you're looking for sort of about 15,000 euro, like 16,000 euro. But its value obviously comes in the fact that it is the Nobel Prize.
Of course.
It's been struck, as I said, in the Mint of Norway. Waiting to be for its next recipient to go out to that. So the 2020 winner will obviously be receiving that.
And
that will be, as I said, it's December the 10th. It's the anniversary of Alfred Nobel's death. And that ceremony will take place in Oslo. And so the recipient goes to Oslo in the presence of King Harald, of the King of Norway, and they actually give a lecture. And in return for giving that lecture, they obviously receive the medal. Yes. They also receive a very nice diploma and a large cheque as well, which I'm sure is very
And how was that viewed, that man's family put the medal up for auction?
Well, it's quite funny, actually. I mean, I don't know much about that particular one. There have been other families who have who've suggested over the years that they may be interested in selling. Who knows? There might be some others coming up. But as you say, I mean, if the the recipient is particularly well known, obviously, I imagine they could fetch considerably more than the $1 million that the last one had.
What about the future as opposed to the history of the mint business as we approach a cashless society, Justin?
Well, now that's opening up a huge can of worms. But I mean, at the Dublin Mint Office, I mean, where the passion sort of within the Samuel Huzik Group and for the Dublin Mint Office is to put history into the hands of our collectors, and certainly commemorative coins have been around for centuries. I mean, in fact, one of the earliest coin collectors that we know was the Caesar Augustus,
and of course,
2,000 years ago.
As of course, if we become a cashless society, they'll be more sought after.
There will always be a need for commemorative coins and medals.
Justin Robinson, thank you very much.
Hey, you're very welcome. Thanks for having us.
And Peace Prize medal, thank you for coming into the studio. That's it from us. Mary Wilson is on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Monday evening.